Jan and I are going to talk to you about our heart in regard to some of the things we're seeing in our society. We hope to give there's a overarching tendency right now rebelling against any kinds of authority and trying to equalize authority, and we see that in critical race theory and Black Lives Matter and the gender wars and all of that. So we hope to give a refreshing reminder of biblical complementarianism. That's where my wife and I are. And our view of this has been shaped by the Bible primarily, but also there was a big thick book back in the 1990s called Recovering Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. I don't know if anybody is aware of that, but that was edited by John Piper and Wayden Grudem. So our primary understanding has been shaped by that kind of resource.
And then more recent treatments, I just finished reading a book by Kevin DeYoung, Men and Women in the Church. Excellent, excellent book. And we're going to be referencing a 5-part blog series that I found incredibly helpful. Jonathan Lehman did a 9-mark series called Complementarianism, A Moment of Reckoning. And you'll have links to that. That was incredibly helpful.
And those resources should be at the back of your notes there in regard to a bibliographic reference. So I think they've developed some since biblical manhood and womanhood, and just trying to understand this and put a little bit more flesh on it as well. I think this session is needed because just all the cultural pressures, as I mentioned, to eliminate all authority, but that's really not what's happening. They're rebelling against authority, but only to replace authority with other authority, my authority in some way. And so that's what's happening right now, and that's the cultural dynamic of rebellion anyway. And there's, in addition, we want to do this because there's a sinful inclination of those in authority to abuse it. That's not surprising to anybody, and for husbands in particular as well, for them to abuse it. And this is not the major manifestation, but my wife and I have seen husbands, I'm not talking about abuse, that is an abuse of authority, but there's a tendency that I have seen in husbands to try to quickly get to the point of saying, hey, well, we're just going to have to agree to disagree, and because the husband gets to make the final say, then his way wins. And I have seen over time that the agree to disagree quickly is a shortcut for the husband to get his way anyway. And that's problematic. And number 3, the Bible gives us clear and hopeful path to gospel-centered authority. Authority is not wrong. There is a biblical, beautiful model of authority as well that we want to make sure that we present.
You know, on a personal level, we have certainly struggled with these things too. I feared being under authority, and I didn't really initially know how. Brent didn't really know how to wield authority for the benefit of others. So that's a great way to start your marriage, right? Yep. I don't want to be under it, and he doesn't know how to do it. So, but God is good, and here we are.
We need a book for these things. And we have one.
And so for me, one example in my life is a fear that, because we believed, and still do, that the Bible teaches complementarianism. Yeah. I believe that. When I got married, I believed that. And I wanted to honor the Lord by trusting the Lord and staying under my husband's authority unless he asked me to sin. I know we all love to get to say that. It's true. And then I had a child. And a fear surfaced after Josh was born that I didn't anticipate, especially because we talk with a lot of couples, and I see, one thing you need to know about my husband is explosive anger is not a term anyone has ever used to describe my husband. Okay, so that's not even a legitimate expectation or fear that I have. But being around a lot of others, seeing this child that I now learned I could kill for, I never knew if I could shoot someone. I don't know if I'd be effective at it, but I know motive-wise I could do it. So here's my thinking. What if Brent ever got sinfully angry with my boy and was going to beat him? Because we know what happens. I mean, I hear about those things. What if he then said to me, leave the room? He's not specifically asking me to sin. It's not a sin to walk out of a room. Do I have to go? And there was just this fear. Do I need to submit and trust God? So I talked to Brent about it. So, I mean, I know you've never done this, but what's the right thing to do in that situation? And that's where Brent explained to me biblical limits of authority. That was so, so helpful. And we'll talk about that more. But the minute that he was acting on a desire to hurt our son, he was already acting outside his authority. And once he's outside his authority, I do not have to stay under that. I needed to protect my son, even though it meant putting myself in harm's way, and he might hit me. And that's what he said. You know, you get in the middle of someone like that, it is not wrong, but you may get hurt. But that was okay with me, and it would put me in harm's way. But that understanding of a limit on all human authority really helped me, because in a broken world, all of our authority is flawed. And in general, for me, submitting felt like giving something up. It felt very vulnerable. I just have to do whatever Brent wants. So add to that, we neither one saw it modeled biblically. And that's what we wanted to talk about. This session is on the authority end. We've done a podcast episode and previous BCTC lectures on the submission end. And I recommend those as well, but this is more on the authority end. So first, let's just think about biblical authority, not just husband, but biblical authority in a variety of relationships. And I want to be the first one to say, as one who is certainly in this relationship under my husband's, biblical authority is good. It's good. I know we've seen things that are not good, but biblical authority is good. And like all of God's principles, it's part of God's good creation that we love to warp. Because we're in a world where authority is marred by sin, and because we sinfully don't want to be under any authority, even if it's godly, we don't like to say authority is good. But it is. And I think the first thing we want to do is, Brent just is going to share with us for a little bit why it's good.
So going back to the Garden of Eden, so Genesis chapter 1, this is going to be one of my illustrations in regard to what is our purpose. Have any of you guys just seen the way that I develop purpose, visible representation of the invisible God?
Raise your hand.
So raise your hand if you've seen that. Okay, few. A few of you. Okay, I normally do it in a different way. I'm going to do it on PowerPoint this time. But in the beginning, God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing. Now, there's a variety of understandings of what image and likeness means. Now, I used to believe, because this is what I taught, and I was taught, that image and likeness simply means something like God has emotions and a will, and therefore I do too. So I share the same capacities of God in some way. So because I'm made in the image of God, I share these similar capacities. And while I completely agree with that, I think there's a little bit more to it. And there's a aspect of our purpose in image and likeness as well. So when Moses wrote Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, the entire known world understood what image and likeness meant. And let me give you kind of just a picture of that in the ancient Near East. So that's Israel right there. And so when Moses wrote the word image, that conveyed something to the entire audience that maybe not convey it to us unless we understand the context. So the metaphor is something like this. In the ancient Near East, a great king would arise. And so let me represent that great king by the crown. And typically, that area right there is the Babylonian area. So the great king would arise in that area. And he would go conquering across the known world. He couldn't go down this way. If he wants to go to Egypt down here, he couldn't go across this way because there's a desert here and his armies would die. So he's going across the Fertile Crescent with the Euphrates and Tigris rivers there, and he's conquering up north, which is Syria and Turkey, and then he comes down the land of Canaan, and then he goes all the way down to Egypt. After he has conquered the entire known world at that point in time, then he wants to go back and enjoy his spoils of his reign and sit on his throne in the Babylon. And what he does, though, is he leaves something in each of those countries that he has conquered. He leaves a statue. That statue is in his image and likeness. And those two words, image and likeness, in the ancient Near East, those two words are used of that statue. Okay, so if you go back into the ancient text,